You're about to listen to the Complete Developer Podcast, the podcast by coders and for coders about all aspects of life as a developer.
I'm Will, the curmudgeonly experienced developer.
And I'm Beach, the optimistic newbie developer. Welcome to another episode of Complete Developer Podcast. Before we get started, Will, what have you been fighting this week?
A lot of bad planning and, you know, other things. You were over here Friday night, and we got my server back in the rack, and got the battery back up in the rack. And of course, I still can't plug it in because the electricians haven't made it out. You know, even though I've been after them for a while, they're coming here in the next few days. And this weekend, I kind of graphed out like everything I want to do before April, before I actually start on my New Year's resolutions. And like 3/4 of the stuff on there is blocked by not having that one plug.
Yeah, you were showing me with your hands.
It's like if my fingers were the things I want to get done, my wrist is them making the plug. Like, it's all dependent. I can't get to any of those things because they're in the way. I'm dealing with that. Work has been pretty good. There's been some learning experiences there. Yeah. We had some interesting hardware problems last week, two of them, it's really crazy how slow a system gets with RAID when one of the drives is not working. It's like, okay, this should be a fast server. Why is it running like a 486? Like, you try to remote desktop into the box, and I mean, you could go to the bathroom and come back before it would log you in. It was extremely slow, and it's like, okay, this isn't network latency because it's, you know, like 15 feet away. Mm-hmm. And that's what it turned out to be, was just the hard drive gradually getting worse. And so they've got that fixed, and man, it's snappy now. So, yeah, so I've had all kinds of fun with all that stuff, and I really didn't get a whole lot done this weekend. Of course, I say that. I've been continuing to port my blog over to Hexo. And that's going really well, really fast. I mean, it's still going to take me probably a few more weeks to really get that done, but I'll be so glad. I think I got like 20 messages today on WordPress for attempts to hack the blog.
Not like the 2,000 I got?
Yeah. So I guess now it's time to talk about what you were fighting, which you never did actually tell me the full story.
Oh, yeah. It's because I got really busy. It's been kind of a hectic weekend for me. I had an interview on Monday of last week, and that went well. It's right down the road from where you work, so we and he who shall not be named all went out to lunch that day, and then still haven't heard back from them. We had lunch with the recruiter on Friday, and she kind of told us that it's between me and one other person, and so you know how negotiations and all that stuff go. Hopefully I'll hear something in the next week. In the meantime, I was contacted by another recruiter for a front-end job. After submitting my resume and portfolio, they wanted to skip the phone interview and go straight to the assessment. So I've spent the entire weekend working on that. And before that happened, I'd actually installed Hexo on Windows and Linux machines, and I was going to play around with that this weekend, but it was an interesting challenge that they sent me. I had to write basically a kind of a list with the view for each item on the list in the format that they have on their website, but I was not allowed to use any frameworks, like front-end frameworks. So no Bootstrap.
None of the stuff that you would actually do.
Yeah. They just wanted to see if I could do it. And it may be because I bragged a little bit about when I first started learning JavaScript, you made me learn it.
Without jQuery.
Yeah. And so it may be because I bragged about that, that they thought, oh, well, let's see what he's got. I don't know if they just wanted me to do the list view component, or if they wanted me to create the entire example page that they sent me. So I created the entire example page. I either did exactly what they wanted, or I went way overboard.
Yeah, of course, I took a programming test last Monday. I don't remember if I mentioned it or not.
I don't think you did.
It was a programming test, you know, the recruiters I work with, they had been sending some people out to this particular client, and the client had a test. You know, it's a simple programming test to make sure that you actually are worth talking to. Because you have a lot of people that think that they can become programmers because they have, you know, written a for loop in JavaScript. And that does, or they've built an HTML page. And so you've got to, like, if you're an HR manager, you pretty much have to find some way to sort through that. And these people were complaining that this test was too hard. And so I was talking to the recruiter I work with, and she mentioned that, you know, this had come up, and, you know, they're trying to get somebody to take the test. I'm like, well, I'll take it. You know, I set it for 5:30. I came home. I cracked open a beer, got on the remote desktop. I did it one line of code.
Which is funny, because you told me what the test was, and I don't think before you told me how you did it, I could have done it in one line of code. Of course, after you explained it, I was like, oh, now I see how you did that. But
yeah, it really wasn't that bad. It was a good test for filtering that kind of stuff. You see a lot of tests that are, you know, for people that are potential new hires that are not really good tests. Like, you know, I got one a month or so back, and one of the questions was, what's the difference between covariance, contravariance, and invariance? Yeah, myself and he who shall not be named, you know, I got this question, and he's like, I don't know. He goes, do you know? And I go, no, I don't know. I use those principles all the time. We don't call it that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we looked it up. It's like, okay, so what does this mean? And, you know, when we look it up, it felt like we knew even less after we read the definitions. And so there's bad tests out there, and then there's also people that are not prepared for tests. Mm-hmm. And so there's kind of that dynamic. So, but I guess it's about time to roll the music.
That glorious music.
It's way better.
All right, this week for IoTs, we have something that Will suggested. We'll let him do a little bit of the talking about this one. This is not exactly an IoT thing, but it's kind of cool. It is a spoon that is more gadgety than Internet of Things, but it's designed to help people who have Parkinson's disease. Will, you want to tell us a little bit about it?
Basically, what it does is, I don't know if you've ever seen or sat at a table with somebody that has Parkinson's or some of those other, there's several other degenerative diseases that do that as well with the shakes. And really advanced age will do it too.
Yes.
But basically, if you've ever seen somebody like that attempt to eat soup or attempt to, you know, eat something with a spoon, you know, their hand shakes and all the food falls off of the spoon repeatedly. This spoon actually auto adjusts to that and keeps the food on the spoon. That's the long and the short of it.
That is really neat. Will showed me a video earlier, and we'll post a link to that in the show notes.
Yeah, and you know, basically the deal is when somebody is suffering from that, you know, they can, at least in, you know, somewhat the early phases, they can still eat, but their hands shake so much that they're having to really, really focus on their food. And so it kind of creates a little bit of social isolation for them.
Exactly.
A lot of times. And so this can really give people their life back. Like I said, it's not straight up IoTs or an IoT thing, because it's not, there's no microprocessor, I don't think, embedded in this. I think it's just a little feedback sensor.
It's more of a gadgety kind of thing, but when you mentioned it, I liked it.
Yeah.
And so I thought we'd bring it up in an episode. So,
well, I mean, this is the sort of thing that can really change somebody's life in a very positive manner. So,
no, and it may not be something that people know about. And so if you have someone in your life that's suffering like this, like a grandparent or somebody, this could be really helpful for them.
Yeah.
So, but thanks for bringing that up for me, because that's really cool.
So in this episode, we're going to discuss manager schedule versus maker schedule. And this all starts out with an essay that Paul Graham wrote, and we'll put the link in the show notes. But essentially, he talks about the way that developers approach things and how it does not interact well with the way management approaches things, because particularly in regards to their schedules. And so he breaks it down into two different types. There's the manager schedule and the maker schedule. He gets into how they both have, you know, their own priorities and they inherently conflict. And basically what it boils down to is developers don't do well with interruptions, which we've covered in episode 13.
Yeah, the why developers hate distractions.
Yeah.
Which was a good episode. We got a lot of good feedback from that.
Yeah, and managers have a similar thing in that they can't always wait on a convenient time because they're in a bit more of a dynamic.
And I think during that episode, we even mentioned that a manager schedule is defined by interruptions.
Yes. So to begin, I guess let's get into what a manager schedule looks like. And Beej, you've managed probably more than me. I've been in a management position twice, and neither of them was for over 6 months.
Sounds about the same. We've probably got about similar experience. How many people did you manage?
In one case, I think it was 7 or 8, but they were part-time, and they were in and out, and they were kind of independent contractor types. And that was massage therapists, of all things, which we won't get into that long story.
Herding cats, huh?
Yeah, and trying to code at the same time, which was just a complete mess. And the other one, there was a team of 3 or 4, and I was kind of a team lead. I didn't have any real authority, but I had responsibility.
I've been in those situations. That's called middle management.
Yeah. Well, it wasn't even at that level. It was just, I was the guy that got screamed at when stuff didn't work.
I worked for a company that does, they're still around. They do housing for people with mental retardation. It's really great because the school system really takes care of kids born with mental retardation up till they're about 21. And then after that, there's not a whole lot of programs. And this is one that their services do everything from managing their finances to helping them find a job and providing occupational assistance and housing and everything like that. And that's the full end of their service. It can go all the way down to just providing housing, and the family can manage their finances and stuff. Each house, which usually had 2 to 3 roommates, was managed by what we called, it was the family teaching model, where a couple lived in the duplex beside them, and they managed the household. And then, yeah, they worked 4 days a week, and then the other 3 days, and the night shifts were covered by staff that came in. And I managed 5 of those homes.
You had to move around, too. You weren't, yeah. People weren't even in the same office.
No, I didn't even have an office. Yeah. Like, I went in once a week for our weekly meetings and to file paperwork. But my job was going from house to house. I tried to visit every house at least twice a week. And I was doing this while trying to go to graduate school.
Yeah. So I guess the fundamental thing, you know, with the structure of a manager's schedule is, if you don't understand this yet, go to your manager's desk and ask to see their Outlook calendar or their Google calendar or whatever their, you know, whatever tool they're using, and just like look at it from across the room. It will look typically like somebody lost a game of Tetris. There's squares everywhere, you know, or it looks like a quilt. They just don't have a whole lot of room in their schedule, because the point of being a manager is, you know, collaboration, synergy. You know, effectively what they're having to do is they are having to work with other people, and they're having to coordinate things and, you know, schedule things and plan things. And so they're constantly, you know, moving around and having meetings and having short chunks of time that they're having to work on one thing. You know, managers typically will have, you know, in those meetings, they have their discussions with their subordinates, the people that are above them, and other managers from other departments. So they're constantly doing this shift and this, you know, back and forth. One of the main features is that their schedule tends to feature a lot of collaboration to actually get stuff done, with a small amount of isolation to get prepared for getting that stuff done. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the way their workload is shifted. The other thing important to remember here too is that management schedules are the schedules of the people that have the most power. Now, contrast this with the structure of an ideal schedule for a developer.
Well, those are going to have very few meetings and a lot more open space in their schedule for development, unless they block that time off. But still, it's going to be, like you were saying, when I was managing, each house that I managed had its own color. It's just how it's an easy visual organization. I could glance at my schedule and see, you know, where I was supposed to be based on the color. With that, you think of the developer schedule, and it's going to be mostly one color if they're using that same scheme.
Yeah, it's going to be very, very sparse. So it's pretty much the opposite of what a manager's schedule looks like. I mean, if you're a developer at an organization that is running well.
That's another thing we've talked about with the surviving meetings was, you know, meeting overkill. If you're a developer and your schedule is looking more like a manager's, there's something wrong.
Yeah, either you need to be moved into a management position or somebody needs to be moved into a management position or you need to move somewhere else. You know, your meetings should really be basically either to report on progress or to gather requirements. And personally, I believe that the reporting on progress mostly doesn't really have to happen in a meeting context.
Well, no, that could be done in an email, couldn't it?
Yeah, most of that can really be done best in a written format if you can type well, which is, curiously enough, something a lot of developers can do, as it turns out. Now, you know, of course, this you still have to have your little daily stand-ups. Like, you gotta have some face-to-face with your coworkers just for...
Get everybody on the same page. And
yeah.
You know, it's like something that we learned here with the podcast was we found that when we hadn't seen each other for a week or two and we tried to record, we ended up going for an hour and a half, sometimes 2 hours.
And we wasted a lot of time, honestly, in there. Yeah.
And so what we've started doing is if, like, we hadn't seen each other in a couple of weeks. And so before recording,
it took us an hour and a half because we've learned to just kind of wind that down. And it is important to remember that that is one of the functions of a meeting. And that's probably the biggest thing that a stand-up meeting really brings to the table is a little bit of team cohesion and getting some of the chitter chatter out of the way. It's like, if you look at developer schedules, you know, we discussed with the manager schedule, they collaborate a lot and then they're isolated a little to get prepared. Well, developers the other way around. We're isolated a lot and we collaborate a little to get ready. And so this kind of will help. It helps with the isolation of the team. These two structures are completely different.
Yeah.
Like, they're lopsided in opposite directions. And you'll have some people that are kind of hybrids too, that are like a team lead position. It's like, you don't really have the authority of a manager, but you're kind of working with management. You'll have a few more meetings than some other people. Or if you're a senior dev, you know, you'll get pulled into all kinds of stuff. When it's like, I'm not management, but you know, there's been days I've had most of my day chewed up by meetings.
Yeah, I've been interviewing. They pulled in all the senior devs that I would potentially be working for.
Yep.
Or for working, that I would potentially be working with. Yeah. And, well, it was supposed to be a 30-minute meeting with them. We kind of got along really well and ended up going 45 minutes because we got to talking and just...
Yeah, and it totally wrecked those guys' days too because like one thing you start to realize, especially as your workload gets more difficult and more tied into the guts of things, is that not only is the interruption a problem, but it's the fact that the interruption is coming up. When you know it's coming, you end up not starting anything that's ambitious because you're trying to protect yourself from knowing that you're going to screw up if you get interrupted.
Well, that's like when I came down here this afternoon, I spent the day working on a JavaScript project I've got. And I guess about an hour or two before I left, I was at a good stopping point. And I knew that if I moved on to the next thing I wanted to do, I wouldn't be able to get it done before I needed to come down here.
Yeah.
And so I just said, all right, well, I'll go play some Minecraft for an hour, walk the dog, and, you know, stuff like that.
Yeah. I mean, that tension between those two ways of approaching things is a little tricky to overcome. You know, because, again, the manager doesn't have the same schedule as you. And you're not in a position of power to change their schedule. There's a few things that managers can do that will make this better. You know, a lot of developers get, they do well and then they get penalized by being moved up into management. I mean, it effectively works that way. It's not looked at as a penalty for them, but it it works out that way because they wanted to code. You know, a lot of people get into computers because they don't want to deal with other people all the time, and they do it well enough, and then they become managers.
That's what happened to me at the management job I talked about earlier. I was being groomed to be a behavior analyst, and then the company got bought and roles were redistributed. And since I had more experience with management and didn't have my master's degree yet, they put me there as a permanence position.
So there's a few things managers can do, obviously, to make this better. The biggest thing is, instead of waiting for the developers to come to you about this, is to restrict interruptions to a predefined time window and go, look, guys, I'm only going to bug you between, X time and Y time. If you have a morning stand-up meeting, that time needs to be somewhere around there. Like, don't booger up the morning and then do the same thing the afternoon and, put that time in the middle, because that basically means your developers are not going to try anything complicated because they're always waiting on an interruption. And they're afraid that, you'll get neck deep in a stack trace and then you got to go talk to somebody.
Yeah, and as a kid, my favorite days in school were the days that we didn't follow the schedule.
Yeah.
I've got a bit of a rebel in me. I like to go do the different things. Until I was able to control my own schedule, and I didn't have one, because my favorite was when I didn't have a schedule, so I thought it'd be better to not. And I very quickly realized the reason I liked those days was because they were a relief from the regular schedule. They were very rare and far between, but that's what I liked about them. They were something different that did not happen often. People that have known me most of my life, they see how, I want to say well organized, but well scheduled I am.
Yeah.
And it surprises them because that doesn't fit my personality.
At all.
No, it doesn't. And I explain them, like, yeah, I really love the unscheduled, the random,
The thing is you create space for that, because if your entire life was random, you'd be too broke, too overloaded, and too tired to do random things that are actually fun.
And I learned that through experience in my 20s, early 20s. You were there for some of it.
I do remember that. Not so fondly, but I do remember it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, I kind of learned the same thing, and it's a lesson that repeats itself, is being able to control your day. Because the other thing this does is, when you interrupt somebody, I've worked at quite a few places that something comes up, they immediately come over. Like, they'll send an email, and then, like, as soon as they hit send on the email, they get up and they walk your direction. You actually get real good at disappearing as soon as you see an email. If you're far enough away, you can just, because it's whatever you're doing is shot, because they're going to come and basically pee in your brain as far as that goes. Cause it's like, you just can't, you can't focus on anything. And really, as a manager, you get raked over the coals when your team doesn't perform. So you're not even shooting them in the foot. I mean, yeah, you can throw a few of them under the bus, but after a while, upper management is going to realize that the common factor in all your problems is you. Then you're gone and you're on the job market as a middle manager. Another thing is, other than restricting your own interruptions, is keeping other parties from scheduling meetings with your team without working through you first. Some of this has to do with organizational structure. Like, if you're in charge of the team legitimately and you're responsible for what they're doing, as a manager, you do not want other people jumping in and causing problems, because those people are not going to be held at fault. It's also a place that you really kind of want to stake your territory. And it doesn't mean, silo and, don't work with other people. It just means have a little consideration.
And we started off this whole podcast talking about social interactions and developers talking to non-devs and things like that. That is a big function of your job as a manager, is you... I go back to the one comment that you made in a previous episode. You can either be an umbrella or a funnel. And if you're a good manager, you protect your team from all of that by having everyone go through you, because all right, I've told them they're going to have the afternoons to focus on heavy stuff that will only schedule meetings in the mornings. Well, people outside of your team may not know that.
Or they may not care.
Yeah, that's true. They may not care. But if they have to go through you to schedule a meeting with your team or with someone on your team, then you know that and you can say, hey, it has to be in the morning because we don't do any meetings in the afternoon.
Yeah, if you look at an organizational chart, you'll see, you know, there's a CEO and then there's, you know, the CIO, the CFO. Sometimes the CIO is under the CFO. Sometimes they're not. There's, you know, there's a couple other departments depending on the business structure, and it looks equal. That is never true. It's fairly rare for the IT department to be anywhere near a level of power, unless you are a software company, which even frequently then you're not. It's shocking just how many, you know, how many companies get ruled by, you know, their marketing department or their, you know, some other department to the point, you know, to the point where it's detrimental.
They're ruled by the one that physically brings in the money.
Another thing you also have to do is you have to make sure your developers are disciplined about actually participating in meetings.
Well, it's kind of the corollary to you have to protect your developers is you're protecting them, but you also have to make sure
you also have to protect the other departments from your developers.
Yes.
And developers are really good, especially we have a lot of interesting personalities in this industry.
Yes, that's a good way of putting it.
A lot of people that don't read social cues at all. A lot of people that frankly have borderline sociopathic tendencies because they're socially awkward and it's pretty much metastasized for them. I worked at a company where there were several developers on the team and there were two guys that never came in on time. We had a 9 o'clock stand-up meeting. These guys would come in at like 10 o'clock, 10:30. So we had the stand-up meeting and then when they came in, everybody got interrupted again because they didn't know what was going on. And management wouldn't come down on it. Instead, they came down on the people who were at work during core business hours who weren't getting anything done. Because these other guys, you know, they come in late and what do? Well, they have their meeting, they interrupt everybody else, then they go to lunch and then they come back and they work for 6 or 7 hours, you know, because, hey, they're, you know, they're 25 and they're single. There's nobody at home that's going to get mad if they get home at 10 o'clock at night.
And getting off at 10 or 11 o'clock at night is the perfect time if you're going to meet your friends out at the club. I know I used to work second shift.
Yeah. You know, you get drunk and come home or vice versa. And, you know, then you get up at 9 o'clock in the morning, you know, throw on some ratty clothes and get into the office and everybody else is kind of trailing in your wake. As a manager, it's very important to, you've got to do damage control on these kind of people. And the thing is, it's damaging for their careers too, because they're not going to get, you're not going to get past mid-level.
They may not even realize it. I was listening to one of my favorite podcasts, the Code Newbie podcast today. The guest was talking about a friend of hers that, and I think he's her mentor is what she was saying, but he has a site called Letters to My 25-Year-Old Self. You know, she talked about that a bit, and that makes perfect sense with what you're saying, because a lot of times at that age, you're going through a lot of learning and growth and changes. And if you don't have someone there,
and you're totally free from your parents and you're totally free from whatever structure, because like if you fail out of college, people are going to be on you a whole lot more than if you just get fired. And it's very easy for the inner slacker to come out for a while. And I think everybody kind of goes through that.
You know, I would have to agree with that. I mean,
and so you have to, as a manager, that's one thing that you want to really be very conscientious about is what, you know, what the developers are doing to each other in terms of schedule too, because there's going to be some people with some just weird schedules. I mean, I get told all the time, of course I can't do it now because I have to drop my daughter off at school, but I remember getting told, look, you're, you know, it's great that you come in early, but that doesn't mean you can leave early because core hours are, you know, fixed. And it's like, you can't leave before four. There's places I've worked where I've gotten in at, you know, 10 after six in the morning and had a, you know, short lunch break. It's like, well, I should be able to leave before four.
Yes.
Because I'm a morning person and that I can get most of my work done before all the irritating people are there. That wasn't allowed either. And it's completely reasonable because the manager is trying, you know, the developer is trying to run a computer. to do something. The manager is trying to run a team, and it interferes with the operation of the rest of the team.
Yes, that makes sense. I mean, I remember when I was doing my graduate practicum, the way that where I was living, the school zones worked out for that semester. The practicum started at 7:45 in the morning. If I left at a certain time, I would get there at 7:15. If I left 5 minutes later, I would get there at 8:15.
Yeah.
And so I remember I showed up, I think my second day, because the first day I was told to show up around noon or something, because it was just meet the team kind of thing. My second day, my first full day, I showed up at 7:30. You know, nothing was really said. No one else was there but the doctor that I was working with. And then I did that for 2 or 3 days. And finally, I think about after the third day, he came up to me and said, "This is kind of my time for me." Because I'd been sitting in his office chatting with him until everybody showed up.
Yeah, you were killing his productivity.
Yeah, and I didn't realize that because I just thought, well, he, you know.
As a manager, that's also something that can happen a lot, yeah. Especially if you've got, you know, somebody that really looks up to you, is they can completely obliterate your schedule, and you know you're not prepared for your meetings.
Exactly. And so he told me that, and I explained to him, I said, well, the problem is if I leave 5 minutes later, I'll be 30 minutes late.
Yeah.
And I said, if you'll just open, because there was a small, yeah, little cubby hole for the students. 3 students fit in there, plus all our filing cabinets.
Wow.
Yeah. It was tight. But I told him if he would just open that up, I would come in and I'd make coffee for everyone in the morning, and I could get some work done in there. The problem was every semester the students changed, and there was no set filing system, because every time someone came in,
they changed it,
and they changed some of the files, but not all of them. So if you had to look up a patient that hadn't been there in a couple of years,
it's like, how did the Sumerians organize their streets versus the Babylonians?
Yes, exactly.
And then it turns out that, this one guy was Akkadian.
So I spent my mornings that semester reorganizing.
Well, and I mean, that's part of this too, is when your developers are wasting your time, wasting others' time, they aren't able to grow.
That's true.
Effectively. And some of that's that team growth. You're pruning the bonsai tree.
Mm-hmm.
Now, developers can do some stuff to make this whole thing better.
I think if managers can, the developers can too, even if they don't have the power to control other schedules.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you can control things without controlling things. I don't know if you remember the movie My Big Fat Greek Wedding.
Very vaguely, yes.
Do you remember, I think it was an older Greek woman that says, the man is the head of the household, but the woman is the neck?
I do remember that, yeah.
Okay, this is what developers are. The manager is the head of the team, the developer is the neck. It doesn't mean you can turn the manager any which way, because sometimes the manager won't go that way, and there's a loud snap. But, you know, it's not a perfect thing, but you do have a little bit of power here. And but you know, the biggest thing you can do is keep your manager informed. Like, if you're trying to keep the manager's schedule from damaging yours and your ability to be productive, the biggest thing you can do for them is keep them informed. And we talked about this when we talked about the interruptions and how to mitigate that.
Yeah. And, you know, I've seen this firsthand, not exactly with a manager that I have, but I was interviewing at a place that wasn't for a development position. It was for a recruiter position. The manager was talking to me on the phone. We talked a couple of times. And he asked me, he's like, "Yeah, I know that development is more kind of what you're interested in." And he said, "You know, are you going to be able to put in a full day's work here and give it your all?" And I told him, I said, "You're right. Development is what I want to do." It's like, I don't know. I may get in there and really love recruiting and just hit it off. And, you know, he responded with, "Yeah, we've got some people that have been doing this for 10, 15 years. And I said, "You know, I don't know if that will happen, but I can tell you honestly now, I want to be a developer. That's where my path is taking me. If that path includes working as a recruiter with you for a few years, then I don't mind doing that. And when I'm at the job, I'll give it my 100%. but when I'm home, I'm going to be on my computer. And he was very impressed with the honesty.
Yeah, and it's not just the honesty thing, but if people already know what's going on, they don't ask.
That's true.
Which, this is how stage magic works, because the audience thinks that they know what's going on, and then all of a sudden, the curtain comes up and the person's gone. And it's really that same kind of principle, right? You make sure the management knows what's going on to the degree that they need to. And, you know, that doesn't mean be deceptive. It means that you keep them informed in such a way that they can do their job. You know, like you don't get into all the minutia of, oh, this code really sucks and da 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 da, because what impression are you forming? Yeah. You're forming the impression that you're overwhelmed when really all you're doing is complaining. So it's keeping them informed, but being cognizant of what that information does. Think of it as a payload going to another server. You don't want a buffer overflow.
And I would also say with that, keeping them informed, and we talked about this in a couple of episodes, showing them in our time management episode, especially a time tracker one, with you can use that to show them how when you don't have meetings scheduled, your productivity goes up during this time. Part of keeping them informed is letting them know, hey, you know, when I'm not randomly interrupted, but I know there's scheduled interruptions, I'm able to plan for that. And we have a meeting at 9. I come in at 7:30. I know I've got an hour before I need to start preparing for the meeting.
Yeah.
So I will do something that takes about an hour, you know, and then the rest of the day after lunch, I know we're not going to have any meetings, so I can focus on more difficult tasks then.
Yeah. And it's just the idea of pruning their behavior as well, because a manager is going to change their behavior based off of their team. If you have a team of extreme introverts, you don't handle it the same way as you do, you know, some guys that practically should have been in sales but ended up being a dev team.
And I would agree with that. That's
so that back and forth is sort of necessary. And so you want to keep that communication channel open. Another thing is actually, if you have a meeting, show up on time, show up prepared. Don't waste other people's time. Don't waste your manager's time.
Ultimately, you're also wasting your time.
Yeah, and you're going to be held accountable for what you get done, yes, too. And, you know, they're going to be saying, oh, well, he didn't pay attention to the meeting, or he talked too much during the meeting. You know, I had a position where I was told that I wasn't a team player. And the thing was, is I felt like the meetings were a waste of time, which I still will argue that they were. But what ended up happening is we were having meetings, you know, 3 and 4 hours a day. There just wasn't anything for me to say. I mean, we were in these meetings where we were discussing stuff, and it's like, I didn't know how all the pieces fit in. Nobody told me. And I'm sitting there, and it's like, I'm not talking. It's not that I don't want to participate. It's just that I hadn't got anything to say. And we know that this other department that we're working with is hostile. And so I don't want to go in there looking stupid. And so I kept my mouth shut and then got told I wasn't a team player. And you want to avoid that dynamic. You know, that may mean, you know, that also means keeping your manager informed. Go, hey, look, I don't know what's going on here.
When I first started working in sales in the insurance industry, my most recent job, I made sure when we had our district meetings to sit near my manager. Like, it ended up being our whole team sitting together because we got along really well. But I think everybody else on the team kind of had the same idea, except for some of the people that had been around for a long time. But by sitting by him, I could easily lean over and say, what are they talking about? Because I was still learning. It was very early on in my career there. And
well, and the last place you want to be is your manager assuming you understand something when you don't.
That is so true.
Because then instead of, oh, hey, this guy needs training, or maybe he's, you know, he needs a little bit of help or something. Now it looks malicious. You know, once that impression is made, even if they discover later that, oh, no, he just didn't understand, then they start feeling like you're hiding that from them. Like there's really no good way to recover. And so that's a place you don't want to be. Another thing, and anybody that listens to this podcast will know that you have this problem and I have this problem, is being brief and on point.
Yes.
When you're having a discussion with them, you don't want to have the rambling conversation around, you know, 15 different things. If you come into their office to talk about one thing, it's the same thing in meetings.
Yeah. And, you know, And I think you and I are very good at determining when it's appropriate and when it's not.
Yeah.
Like,
because sometimes it is a social call.
Yeah.
And but I guess I've sat in quite a few, you know, like stand up meetings have the worst reputation of anything. Like out of all the agile, well, not out of all the agile principles, because pair programming gets a pretty bad rap too. The stand up meetings here, they're supposed to be, okay, you stand up for 5 minutes, everybody says what they're doing, and then you go sit down and do your work. It's just enough of a touch point. And there's always that one guy, and I've never, like, you know, and I say, oh, it's always that one guy. That's not anything sexist. I've literally never seen a female programmer do this. But there's always the one dude that's got to show how smart he is by how much he talks. And we'll take the whole team up talking about some little, you know, like he and one other guy work on one corner of the system and nobody else looks at it. And they have an architectural discussion there that literally is relevant to no one except the two guys that are sitting side by side the rest of the day.
See, this is where the manager comes in, and a good manager will say, hey, guys, this is not relevant to what's going on. Thank you for the update. And it can be said in a way that lets them know, hey, this isn't the place for that, but yeah, in a polite manner.
Yeah, well, and I mean that's a manager's role too. It's also the role of a developer to go, okay, hey, you know, look, I gotta get back to it.
There's ways of doing that are not rude too.
Yeah.
Because I can, as we were talking about this, I'm seeing
you're visualizing me in that situation, going, ooh.
And I'm seeing what I would do if it happened on such a regular basis, and the people had been talked to about it, and they were still doing it. I would just get up and walk away. And
that's exactly what I've done on many occasions, because I realize that I get blamed if I don't get things done. And so as far as I'm concerned, this person is directly harming my ability to put food on my family's table because they're trying to show out for somebody, or they're trying to paper over what they don't know or whatever. And it's like, okay, if you want my input, that's great. But a lot of times when I've seen this, it's been, you know, they're in some, like I said, they're in some corner of the system and they're doing something that is so remote from anything I know that
there's no need for them to be talking about this with you.
Yeah. It's like, okay, well, I think that, you know, I mean, I've even been in a discussion where it's like, I think we ought to solder this other way instead of doing it this way on these particular type of boards because of, you know, of a heat problem. And I'm sitting here going, you know,
why are you even there?
How many pancakes can fit on the roof? It's that relevant to me. It's like, why am I in this discussion? And, you know, we did have good management at that point that was like, hey, this isn't
the time or the place for that.
Yeah.
There is a time and place for it, but this isn't it.
Yeah. Somewhere else in a place that I'm not.
Yeah. And that leads right into the last point here, which is to point out tactfully how much damage distractions do. Yeah. I mean, they're so bad. We did an entire episode on them. Really, we could have done a whole series on the damage of distractions.
Yeah, and a lot of times your managers either, you know, they don't know. It's very common, especially with project managers. You know, they come in, they get managerial authority, but they've never coded. They've never actually done that work and done it for long enough that the pain points are in their mind. And the other thing you'll see this with is developers that kind of have euphoric recall. I've seen this with devs that were like, oh, well, I used to develop in Fox Pro. And I don't mean Visual Fox Pro. I mean Fox Pro. Or I used to do something, you know, I did Borland C++ back in, you know, 1991.
I learned Borland C++ in high school.
Yeah, but you know, they have this memory, but the thing is the rest of the industry has changed. Like back then, they were doing waterfall development. You know, they build the big plan up front and all the pieces of the system are spec'd out. And it's like, I got to do this and I got to do this and I got to do this.
I remember learning that.
Yeah. Whereas now everything's reactive. It's, I'm doing this. Oh, crap. Something happened. I have to go over here and fix this. Or we got a customer request for this thing. Stop what you're doing. Commit that branch and then jump over here, make a new branch and do the next thing.
It's more feature-centric.
Yeah, it's feature-centric, and it's more responsive to the end user. And as a result, they have what's called euphoric recall. Like they remember a happier time when a distraction wasn't a problem for them. And the reason is because everything was laid out in front and there was a defined path. And a distraction, you know, you were this far down on the checklist.
Yeah, and when you came back from the distraction, you knew exactly where you were picking up because...
Well, and it had only been like 30 minutes. It wasn't, oh yeah, hey, we decided to chase this, you know, go down this rabbit hole for a year or something ridiculous. And it's kind of important to tactfully talk to your manager and go, look, this is really hurting me with these distractions. Like I can't... And you've got to be very careful about how you do it, because what you don't want to do is look like you're helpless or you're complaining.
Yeah, and that's where the tactfulness comes in. A lot of times, if you can take data to them and show them, hey, I am more productive on the days that we don't have distractions, and I know I'm graded on my productivity.
Yeah, well, and another thing too, even you can actually sort of drop hints about it. You go, okay, so we're doing this. Like, well, can I do that on this day instead of this day? Because that's when I'm better at that sort of thing, because there are fewer distractions.
Makes sense.
you're not suggesting what the manager needs to do.
You're asking permission.
Yeah. You're kind of setting your own schedule. The other thing too, is that shows that your ability is that shows a more senior level of ability because you're self-aware.
That's very true.
It also sets the manager up to do something that helps you help them.
Yeah, because it makes them look good.
And it's their idea. So there's no territory stepping happening there.
Also, they remember that. Yeah, I know in other industries, when it's promotion time and a position is open, your manager will remember those types of things. And
if they get promoted and they have to promote somebody into their old role, which I've seen happen, they're going to want somebody that they feel like is part of their team. And this, it's not so much that it helps it. It just keeps from breaking it down by ticking people off.
Yeah, that's very true.
And it's just a better way to treat another human being as if they're a dignified, self-aware creature.
And I think that kind of wraps it up. So before we close out, let's do a quick review of what we've covered. So we started off with talking about the essay by Paul Graham basically states that the developers and the manager's schedules are inherently conflicting in their priorities. Developers can't do well with interruptions, and managers can't always wait on a convenient time. We then talked about the structure of the manager's schedules, and if you look at a manager's schedule, it, as Will stated, looks like a lost game of Tetris.
Well, and that's why in the outline it doesn't say structure, an ideal structure for a manager's schedule, because having done management, I'm not sure there is an ideal. I think they're pretty much all terrible in their own way.
Mm-hmm. They tend to be a lot of meetings with either their managers, their subordinates, or their peers. And they do a lot of collaboration. There's a lot of social interaction with being a manager. Whereas the structure of an ideal schedule for a developer is kind of the opposite, because it looks very sparse, with often fewer meetings, and mostly those meetings are to report on progress or gather requirements. The developers, we tend to be isolated with little collaboration, and that collaboration is just to get prepared for what we're doing in isolation. We then covered what managers can do to make this better, and that includes restricting interruptions. It goes back to several different things we've said throughout this episode and other episodes about having a predefined time window for interruptions. Yeah, it's just the best way to do it.
And it's, you know, it's sort of the thing of, you know, when it otherwise, if you're interrupting your developers all the time, it's like a small child that plants a seed. They'll dig it up to see if it's growing, and they'll kill it. That may be from his essay, actually, but because for some reason I read that recently.
They can also keep other parties from scheduling meetings with their developers without going through them. And also make sure the developers are disciplined about participating and showing up to meetings. And finally, what can we as developers do to make this better? And that's keeping our managers informed of what's going on. If they know what we're doing and what's going on with that, they're less likely to come and ask us and interrupt us. Showing up on time to our scheduled meetings, that's just a politeness thing. It's professionalism, and it keeps from wasting our time and others' time. Be brief and on point for the items you're supposed to be dealing with. When you're giving your report in a meeting, be succinct. Get the information out and just the information that needs to be stated. And finally, point out tactfully how much distractions do and how they negatively affect us as developers.
And how your, you know, how your schedule can actually be made to work better.
Yes, exactly. So that wraps us all up. Will, before we close out, what do you have for us for Tricks of the Trade?
Well, I'm going to talk to you a little bit about back of the envelope calculations.
Awesome.
As members of an engineering discipline, computer scientists are often expected to be accurate.
Yes.
Right. That's kind of built in. You know, people don't like it when their financial calculations are off by, you know, several thousand dollars. It doesn't really work very well. You know, and you can't really get, you don't want to be just close. You want to be dead on, right? Mm-hmm. We worry about, you know, how floating point numbers are inaccurate at times and those kind of things. And so this is not intended to be disparaging of that because, you know, you're doing numerical calculations. You really need to get it right. But there's a lot of times that it's very easy to forget that you just need to know that you got enough. If you're trying to test something, you go, okay, yeah, I know it works. And, you know, you do a, you know, this massive statistical calculation and say, I need to run this 2,393 times to get a big enough set, right? You go through all this effort to figure out, you know, how big the statistical set should be. If you ran it 10,000 times and there's not, you know, any significant performance cost or computational cost to it, and you said, you know, I know within an order of magnitude it's somewhere between 1,000 and 10,000, and I just go on the high end, and you ran it, you're good. You know, unless you know, like legitimately have to prove it. Because a lot of times you really don't. These little back of the envelope calculations can really save you a lot of time, right? Because if you go, okay, well, I know, you know, just scratching it out without being too super precise, that, you know, 10,000 iterations is going to be several times what we need, then just go with that and be done with it versus spending a whole bunch of time trying to figure it out, you know, down to a level that you really don't need. That can save you a lot of time. Well, what's interesting is they've actually figured this out with Bitcoin here recently.
You told me about this earlier.
You know, of course, there's the whole process where you generate the Bitcoin and, you know, there's a lot of math there. And it turns out that the numerical methods for this, if you are willing to accept some errors, you can speed it up by like 30%, which is massive.
That's huge, yeah.
What's also interesting is that if you submit an invalid Bitcoin, the system tells you quickly, quicker than you could actually get down to the correct number at all times. So it's actually faster to use the system to verify it. You know, basically to say, okay, I'm going to create a bunch of data, some of which is wrong. It can at times be faster to do that and then just filter out the bad than it is to actually start with good.
I can see that. That makes sense.
I mean, this is why we do stats, mm-hmm. right? Because, you know, this is why the plural of anecdote is not data, is because that's essentially what statisticians do. Like, that's the whole science. Mm-hmm. Is the idea of I'm going to take a bunch of moderately crap data and I'm going to sift through it and try to find the useful bits. That's what they're doing because computationally it's easier for them. This same model applies in software development as well. So long as you don't have to prove something and it's not a financial calculation and nobody's going to die. Just throwing this out there is something to think about a little bit and make sure that you're not wasting your time trying to solve an engineering problem when really what you're trying to actually fix is an approximation problem.
If you have a question or comment for us, please email us at neckbeards@completedeveloperpodcast.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from Stand By for Titanfall by Pure Bells, available on SoundCloud and licensed under Creative Commons. The intro music for IoTs is Hillbilly Hip Hop by Jason Belcher. For references, show notes, and to sign up to our email list, be sure and check out the website at www.completedeveloperpodcast.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at @CompleteDevPod. And like our page on Facebook to keep up with news about the show. Thanks for listening. See you next time.